This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Then we move closer to what we want to talk about tonight, and that is the 20th century after that dying off of Islam. Two generations, it was gone, generally. And that's documented in the history of the family of Salih Bilali of the Sapelo Islands off the coast of Georgia, how three generations after he was a practicing Muslim, his ancestors only remember vaguely some practices, such as their grandparents facing the east and praying, and some general things, and the rice cakes, and the custom of making the rice cakes remaining, but not really knowing the context, the religious and cultural context that led to the rice cakes, or the details associated with the prayer. So it had died off after three generations. And that was one of the few instances where the ancestors even recall Islamic practices by their Muslim grandparents or great-grandparents. So Islam died off for all practical purposes amongst African Americans. Now, we discussed as the latter part of the 19th century, we discussed the work of Edward Blyden, Presbyterian missionary to West Africa, who, according to many accounts, converted to Islam, according to all accounts, had great admiration for Islam. And he situated that in the Pan-Africanist struggle. He saw Islam as potentially unifying the African people and the African diaspora, that Islam could be a unifying force. He also saw in the separatist model that was generally adhered to by West African Muslims, he saw a model for survival of Africans in European-dominated societies in the West. So he was looking at Islam in a very utilitarian sense in terms of how Islam could be used towards a greater end, and that greater end being the goals of Pan-Africanism, unifying the African people, preserving an African cultural identity in the diaspora. But by so doing, he paved the way for Islam being considered as a credible alternative to Christianity during a time, the latter 19th century. So we have to see what's going on. It's the height of the white terrorism, white American terrorism in the South. It's the height of the Ku Klux Klan, the White Legion, and other white racist groups who, as we discuss, why did this terrorism, this wave of terrorism, occur? During Reconstruction, the period where the Northern armies were occupying the South and reconstructing the South after the devastation of the Civil War, full political rights were extended to African Americans. Now, in some states, such as South Carolina, African Americans were a numerical majority. So African Americans were gaining what was viewed, it was proportionate, but it was viewed by the whites as disproportionate political power. You had African American senators during Reconstruction, congresspeople, local officials, mayors. So the white power structure didn't like that. So that's how the Ku Klux Klan was born. So to do away with that political power, after the Northern armies withdrew, a reign of terror ensued, where literally people were murdered, lynched, to discourage African-American voting and political participation on the one hand. On the other hand, you had disenfranchisement laws, and we mentioned many of these are still on the books. So you have felony laws where minor offenses would be labeled as felonies, and then a convicted felon was disenfranchised for life. And naturally, the overwhelming majority of disenfranchised felons were African-American males. These post-Reconstruction disenfranchisement laws, many of them are still on the books in most southern states. So that in the last two elections, one-third of the adult male African-American population in Florida and Alabama have been disenfranchised for life because they're convicted felons. So that started then. So in this climate, many educated African-Americans began to view Christianity as a racist religion. Because what did the Ku Klux Klan march under? Under the cross. So African-Americans, intelligent, educated African-Americans began to view Christianity as a racist religion and began looking for an alternative. So it was at this time that Blyden's work provided an insight into thinking productively about Islam as a credible alternative to Christianity. So this really opened the door for the reintroduction of Islam into the African-American community. Now, Blyden, as we said, no matter what his religion ultimate affiliation was, there are those who say he died as a Muslim. There are those who say he maintained Christianity to the end of his life, despite a favorable view of Islam. But no one disputes he was a Pan-Africanist. And in that regard, his legacy was inherited, as we move into the 20th century, by Marcus Garvey, who started the Universal Negro Improvement Association, or the UNIA. So Marcus Garvey, who was a Jamaican, he was born in the Caribbean in Jamaica in 1887. He spent time in London and several European countries. Now, what's significant about the time he spent in London, one of his chief mentors was an individual, somewhat mysterious individual, by the name of Dusse Muhammad. Dusse Muhammad was an actor. He was a political activist. He was knowledgeable about Islam. It's said he was Egyptian, that he was the son of a Mamluk soldier. His grandfather was a Mamluk soldier who was killed fighting the French in Egypt. So it's said he was Egyptian, said he was Sudanese. Some people claim that he was an African-American convert to Islam. In any case, he was a mentor of Marcus Garvey in London. And he conveyed a lot of ideas to Marcus Garvey about Islam. Now, Garvey never formally accepted Islam, but the UNIA was very favorable in its view of Islam. So this is one contribution of Marcus Garvey to the reintroduction of Islam in the African-American community that, again, building on the work of Blyden, it became in some circles very extremely accepted to discuss Islam. Many of the people in Garvey's movement were Muslims, African-American converts to Islam. Garvey spoke favorably of Islam. But perhaps his greatest legacy in terms of his influence on the Nation of Islam was his idea of a black religion, that black people needed their own religion. And in Garvey's view, that theology was predominantly an Africanized version of Christianity. So Garvey, for example, advocated all African Americans getting rid of their pictures of a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Scandinavian Jesus and getting, if they must, a black Jesus. So then you have the black Madonna, the black Jesus. And these themes introduced into African-American religion. So this would have an influence on the Nation of Islam in ways we'll discuss. Also, Garvey's theology was a theology of liberation and self-improvement, consistent with his movement. So again, this is a theme, as we'll discuss, inshallah ta'ala, if Allah so wills, that characterized African-American Islam, regardless of its strain, if you will. And the many strains we'll try to examine inshallah ta'ala. So the idea of worshiping a black god. So the nation of Islam would eventually come to claim what? That the black man is God and the white man is the devil. So the idea of worshiping a black god, this was something that Marcus Garvey introduced. In addition to that, another influence that Marcus Garvey would have on the nation of Islam was the emphasis on institutionalization. It's one thing to advance ideas. It's another thing to build institutions that reflect those ideas and allow for the articulation of power in the world. Individuals don't articulate power in the world. Institutions do. And individuals are only powerful within the context of institutions. That's a fact. You take any person you think is powerful in the West, divorce them from the institutional context of the United States government, of the United States military, of NATO, or whatever, and see what you have. On the other hand, you might have an idiot who can barely spell potato, for example. On the other hand, take a Muslim with a PhD. No drinking problem, no drug problem, no need for Prozac or Ritalin, very stable emotionally, intellectually astute, personally strong, disciplined, 5 prayers a day without fail, fasting Monday, Thursday, and Ramadan. But take that strong Muslim with no institutional context. What do you have? You have a strong person that's unable to project any power or meaningful influence in the world. That's what you have. So Marcus Garvey realized that. So he realized if the African American and the African people in general, because a Pan-Africanist, based in Harlem, based in the United States, if the African people in general, African Americans in particular, are going to be dignified people or contributing on the world stage, then institutions would have to be built.